I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am here in London on a listening tour, speaking to as many British and English activists as I can reach out to, because I'd like to take home some insights that might be applied to the United States. My guest today is Martin Webster. So, Martin, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Give us a little bit of background about yourself, how old you are, where you were born, your background, your education.
I'm 72 next May, in 3 or 4 weeks' time. I was born in Hemel Hempstead in Hertfordshire, which is a county 20, 25 miles north of London. I was brought up in London from the age of about 2 to the age of 10 in Kensington in London. And then my family moved back to Hertfordshire again to St. Albans, which is a cathedral city where I was educated ultimately by an American Roman Catholic teaching order called the Brothers of the Sacred Heart, who took over a small private school in St. Albans called St. Columba College. And that's where I finished my education ingloriously. After that, I became a cub reporter for the trade and technical newspaper for the cooperative movement called Co-op News, and learned some of the basics of journalism with Co-op News. And soon left home. My political interests and activities estranged me from my parents. I started off as a conservative. I thought I was a conservative. My parents were, and when you're 16 or 17, you think you are what your parents were. And I joined with the family. By then, had moved to Mill Hill in North London. And I joined the Mill Hill Young Conservatives. And they were dullards. They wanted to play ping pong and have dances and stuff like this. And I joined a political youth movement because I was interested in politics. And there were one or two other youngsters who were interested in politics too. And we agitated for a debate. This is when Britain was being cajoled to join what was then called the European Common Market, which later became the European Union. And I was very much against it. I didn't want foreigners exercising any control over my nation. And I thought the whole idea was absurd and treasonable. And there were one or two other youngsters who felt the same way. I think young people are naturally patriotic, whether they're Labour, Conservative, whatever. I think kids are naturally patriotic. And we agitated so much, we eventually got a debate. And the motion was, I was the seconder of the motion, and a slightly older boy was the proposer, that Britain should not join the European Common Market. And none of the adults in this Conservative Association, the main adult party, knew what the common market was about at all. The kids knew more than the adults. And they had to import from Golders Green, which is a big Jewish area, a little bit towards London, away from Mill Hill, Mr. Rose, to present the pro-common market point of view. And my proposer and myself as seconder roused the kids against this takeover, this attempt to homogenize the United Kingdom with all of the other nations in Europe. And the kids were really riled up about this and were clearly going to vote 99% for the motion that we don't want Britain to become a member of the common market. And the Tory agent, who's the party's full-time paid employee, then got up at the back of the meeting and said, "We're all conservatives here. We don't want any arguments amongst the party faithful. So that's it. Now we'll go over to ping pong."
So how old were you when you began?
17.
17. So that was your first adventure as a political agitator?
That's right. And then I was so angry by that, I wrote an article for the YC's Young Conservatives divisional magazine called "Why Isn't the Conservative Party Conserving Anything Anymore?" And they wouldn't publish it. So that was the first party I resigned from and have never gone back. And I joined a small, noisy, right-wing patriotic group called the League of Empire Loyalists.
Now, who founded that?
A.K. Chesterton.
That's right.
Who was the nephew of G.K. Chesterton. And I got the start of my nationalist political education from these people. Their outward presentation to the world as of old-fashioned, countrified, reactionary conservatives who are trying to preserve what the Conservative Party once stood for. But Chesterton, before the war, had been a member of the Moseley's movement, the British Union of Fascists and National Socialists, but resigned in 1938 for reasons that I'm not quite sure about. But he disagreed with Moseley, and he went back into the army and served out a period in the Second World War with the British Army. And then he wrote for a magazine called Truth, which was edited by a man called Sir Colin Brookes, a very famous right-wing, more or less anti-international finance, with all that that implies in terms of anti-Semitism. And Chesterton was also literary advisor to Lord Beaverbrook. And Chesterton told me that he regularly used to go to house parties at Beaverbrook's country estate. And over a period of a year or so, sold to Chesterton the idea that a world government was being formed, that it was dominated by Jewish-dominated international finance, that it meant the obliteration of individual nations and states, the promotion of a homogenized world population, the domination of the world's money by the people who are creating this project. And Chesterton told me, he said, after a while, Beaverbrook indicated to me, he said that he agreed with everything I said, my analysis was right. So Chesterton said, well, look, you own the Daily Express, the Sunday Express, a huge media empire. You're a former cabinet minister in the government during the war years. You are the very man to expose what's going on. And he said, Chesterton told me, Beaverbrook grabbed my arm and said, you don't know what you're asking. These people can tear the flesh from your bones. So he and Chesterton and Beaverbrook fell out. Beaverbrook admitted to Chesterton he knew what was going on and who was doing it. But he had this media empire. In his time, he was the greatest press baron of British newspaperdom, and he wasn't prepared to take the risk. So then Chesterton got writing for Sir Colin Brookes' little magazine, which then got bought out by another bigger media group. I think it was part of Staples Press, and Staples Press got taken over by another media organisation, and the first thing they did was close down Truth. And so Chesterton formed his own little magazine called Candor, which is a continuation of Truth. And a lot of the subscribers and supporters of Sir Colin Brookes' magazine supported Candor, and Colin Brookes' son, Austin Brookes, became Chesterton's number two there, along with a number of other people who are connected with the Chester Bullock tradition in British politics and literature. And as a result of agitation from the ranks, so to speak, they formed the League of Empire Loyalists, who specialised in going out to meetings, particularly of the Conservative Party, and heckling, and hoping through the heckling and disrupting of these meetings and conferences to awaken the British people to the way their country was being betrayed. And Austin Brookes, who was a bearded man, he was a sailor and had a big sailor's beard, when there was a Commonwealth Prime Minister, a Lambeth Palace conference of all of the clergy around the world assembled at Lambeth Palace for a big conference. And Austin Brookes bought himself an Archmandrike's uniform, and that with the beard and the hiring of a Rolls-Royce motor car, drove up to the front of this. It was duly received in and bowed and scraped to, and he had a huge Orthodox cross there and a big thing like that, and promptly walked up to the speaker's rostrum, and with all the press and TV coverage, the League of Empire Loyalists, and it brought the house down. You can imagine, that's the sort of thing the League of Empire Loyalists did.
So what we call trolling on the internet today has a...
Well, no, I think that's heckling and gentle subversion.
Yes.
I joined the League of Empire Loyalists and was active with them for a year or so and learned quite a lot through them. And then we heard of a rally that was going to be held in Trafalgar Square by a new group called the National Socialist Movement, set up by a man called Colin Jordan. Colin Jordan himself had been a member of the League of Empire Loyalists, and they left because it wasn't radical enough for them. It was too fuddy-duddy and old Tory, that sort of thing. And so I missed meeting those people in the League. I came in later. But Colin Jordan and John Tyndall, and who are now both dead, of course, and Dennis Pirrie, who is still alive, living in Brighton. I'm still friendly with Dennis. I was his best man at his wedding years ago. They were going to hold a rally in Trafalgar Square, Free Britain from Jewish Control.
And what year was this?
1962, July 1962. And I should explain that the National Socialist Movement that's going to hold this rally was born of a first British National Party, which in turn was born of a merger between an organisation headed by Colin Jordan in the 1950s called the White Defence League, and another organisation called the National Labour Party, run by a man called John Bean. They came together to form the first British National Party, and Colin Jordan let them have a premises in West London, Notting Hill, 72 Princedale Road, which had been the offices of the Britain's Publishing Company. But this had been left to Colin Jordan by Arnold Lees, who before the war was the leader of the Imperial Fascist League. There's a lot of antecedents and threads going out there. But at any rate, the British National Party was active from about 1959 through to 1960, 61. Then it started to split apart between people who didn't like Colin Jordan's and John Tyndall's very strident, uniformed National Socialist presentation politics. John Bean was a racialist. Not a populist. He was a proper racialist, but he didn't think you need to dress up in German uniforms of the 1930s to sell an idea to the British public in the 1960s. And in that, I think he was right. However, the National Socialist Movement was formed out of a breakup of the British National Party. The British National Party under John Bean continued. The National Socialist Movement held this meeting in Trafalgar Square, and A.K. Chesterton strictly told us, none of you people are to be seen at this Colin Jordan rally, and, you know, it's verboten. Well, of course, I'm 18 or 19, and somebody tells you there's a political meeting in Trafalgar Square that you can't go to. If ever there's a way of encouraging you to do exactly that, that was the formula. So I just went along there, just intending to be part of the crowd, just to listen to what they had to say. And there in the crowd, mostly there were about two dozen National Socialist Movement supporters down on the in the square, about 12 people up on the plinth of Nelson's Column, with big banners up, Free Britain from Jewish Control, and all this stuff. And about 2,000 screaming Jews behind the National Socialist Movement supporters. And amongst them, I recognise all sorts of horrible communist Jews and Zionist Jews who'd attacked us when we were only heckling meetings, but getting quite tasty with us. And I didn't quite understand what the National Socialist people were saying, whether I agreed with all of it, but I knew who the enemy was. So I managed to hop up onto the plinth, and when the Jews were climbing, if you go to Trafalgar Square, you see it's quite a high thing there, you've got to put your fingers on there. And I just walked up and down the side of the plinth, treading on Jewish fingers. After that, the rally ended. There was a big storming and people surging around the place. Not a riot, but a disturbance, and a lorry was drawn up for us to for the National Socialist Movement people to unload all of the banners. And I was on the, I suddenly found myself on the lorry with quite a large Britain Awake banner, which was brought down. on a lot of Jewish heads. And then I just slunk away. But next day on the front page, wouldn't it be the Sunday Express, is the Land Rover there with me on the back with a Britain weight banger binging it down. And I got a letter from Chesterton. Then, dear Martin, you are hereby expelled. Having got into the habit of politics, if you lose one family, you go to another family. And so I joined the National Socialist Movement for about 18 months. I went to this camp in the Cotswolds, which Lincoln Rockwell attended. And I found Rockwell a very intelligent, amusing man. And I wasn't quite sure whether he was serious about his, I don't know whether it was American promotion and exaggeration. And Americans do things rather differently, rather more boisterously than we do in politics. And I don't know whether he was deliberately provoking a reaction in order to draw the enemy out more. That, I think that was his strategy. But he came and he went. He was deported from the country, but he managed to smuggle himself in. And that was a publicity coup. And as I say, I remained a member of the NSM for 18 months. And then Colin Jordan became ensnared with a very nice, very outrageous French woman called Francoise Dior, the niece of Christian Dior. I got to know her later personally very well, but she came over to England. She'd heard all about these real-life English Nazis, and she was certainly a real-life French Nazi. There's no doubt about that. She had platinum swastika, with each hook of the swastika decorated with a diamond, in a black body-clinging leather outfit, a Jewish fantasy, you know. And she came over, and eventually she and Colin Jordan got married, and Colin Jordan wanted her to use some of her money, or at least her mother's money, on buying a croft. Colin Jordan was very fond of the Yorkshire Dales and wanted to buy a croft, a small country house in the Yorkshire Dales. And she said, look, I didn't come over to England to marry a farmer or somebody who wants to sit in his slippers. I wanted somebody who was wearing jack boots. Right. And they had a big bust up, and it was all a mess.
Right.
An unfortunate mess. And John Tyndall, Dennis Peary and myself, we left the NSM, not only because Jordan was distracted by the money of his new wife, which is a shame for his movement, but we'd also come to the opinion that while we were agreed with many National Socialist ideas, our analysis of international finance, of the Jews, of race mixing, that sort of thing, we believe that was still correct. The way of presenting it to the British people is not going to be in the uniform of another people and another culture in another generation. It was Hollywood Nazi stuff, and it was helping the Jews, not hindering them. So we formed a group called the Greater Britain Movement to emphasize the fact that we were interested in Britain.
So John Tyndall was involved in the Greater
Britain. Yes, he was the leader of it. And listen, we're talking about dozens of people here. We're not talking about hundreds or thousands. We're talking about dozens of people. It was a minute splinter group of a splinter group. But at least it was an effort to try and steer the racial nationalist movement in this country towards a British identity rather than reliving yesterday's German identity. We wanted to be the first of tomorrow, not the last of yesterday.
I actually have ViewMaster slides that were taken by Lincoln Rockwell at the Cotswolds camp.
Yes.
And there's you and John Tyndall and Colin Jordan and Lincoln Rockwell and Savitri Devi and some other people standing in front of a big swastika flag.
That's right.
You know, poor John Tyndall was never allowed to live down photos like that in the future.
Well, yes. It's just one of those things. History, as we're seeing in this general election now, every closet is gone into every bit of background. This is something we used to say years later in the when we were running the National Front, that Dennis Healey was an active card-carrying member of the Communist Party, who stayed a member of the Communist Party after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, after Germany and Russia became allied with one another, after Russia had invaded Poland, and remained a member of the Communist Party until he joined, was called up into the army in May 1940. And then he became British Minister of Defence. Now, that, and if we, when we raised that in our magazine Spearhead, that was considered to be a terrible smear against an honourable man. Right. And a youngster is entitled to make his mistakes and to grow through them. But that wasn't allowed to us.
Right.
So that's the difference there. And the Greater Britain movement, John Tyndall was a good platform speaker, but he didn't have much imagination in terms of publicity. And I could see that the Greater Britain movement was very shortly going to become moribund. We had to do something. And I saw that the Commonwealth Prime Ministers' Conference was being held in London, where the Prime Ministers and Presidents of all of the various member nations of the British Commonwealth came together in London that year, 1964, for a conference. And amongst the people coming was Jomo Kenyatta, the twice convicted leader of the Mau Mau conspiracy. So I thought, this is our opportunity. And I, having a journalistic background, I know how the media works a little bit, and I contacted a press agency. I won't name them now, because I always promised that I would never name them. But I met a reporter from this press agency, and I said, I'm swearing you to a secret, but there's a big scoop in this for you if you keep your gob shut. We know that Jomo Kenyatta is living in the Hilton Hotel on the bottom of Park Lane, not just the other end of the big street down there. And I'm going to have a pop at him when he comes out of his hotel. I shall present him with a copy of the Mau Mau Oaths and Ceremonies, which is the most obscene document you could possibly imagine. Cause a ruckus there. It'll be at 9 o'clock in the morning, so nobody else will be around. There'll be no reason for anybody else to be there except you. And I negotiated a fee, which in 1964 was £400. Doesn't sound like a lot of money today, but for a tiny little movement, 24 people, a lot of money. They said, you keep your trap shut about this. We'll pay the money, but you keep it quiet because we've got some government contracts, that sort of thing. So, the day came. There was a special branch detective. That's the sort of secret police we've got here. And a constable outside the hotel. Jomo came out. I barged through the crowd, bumped against the constable. The special branch man did nothing, just stood there with his mouth open. Kenyatta's bodyguard, I'm told, I didn't see it, I am told, produced a heavy old revolver. And the constable who'd wrestled me to the ground, thinking I was going to attack Kenyatta, when all I wanted to do was present him with these, that's the only thing I had on me, the Mau Mau Oaths and Ceremonies, as attested in court reports. The copper who got me on the ground tore his truncheon out and knocked the gun from the police superintendent from the Kenya Police Service, who was allowed. Whether what the truth of that, I don't know, because I was on the ground and had a copper on top of me. So, Judd Tyndall was in Park Lane with a megaphone, bullhorn, broadcasting out the reason why we were doing this, and the new press agency had several photographers and a movie camera there, and they got the whole thing fully scooped. And of course, immediately they then realized that this had been a setup. Why would those people, all those people, all from one agency, be there? at that time, and it got on the front page of all the evening newspapers, the front page of the daily newspapers the following day, on television. Jomo Kenyatta, the headline in the evening news was The Jostling of Jomo. He wasn't actually attacked, but I got prosecuted for bumping into the policeman going through to Jomo, and that was a technical assault. And for assaulting Jomo, apparently he fell backwards against his open car door, and the force of both of us, because I was tripped over and fell, falling on him, and the both of us bent the car door down against the wrong way around against the body, you know, back of the car. Up, and I was taken to prison, and I was let out on bail. And I calculated about a year I would get a prison sentence of about a year. But I had a young barrister called Pakenham. Now, the Pakenhams are a liberal English family, and he was a young barrister on the make, wanted to get a juicy case. Very polite and nice. And he ran a very good defence. And fortunately, I realised that at a magistrate's court, they don't allow you to make political statements. In a bigger trial, you get the opportunity under cross-examination to make political statements. But I knew in a magistrate's court, you didn't get that opportunity. So when I was formally charged by the police, and another Rose appeared in my life, an Inspector Rose was the charging officer. And he said, "Have you got anything to say?" And I did. And I kept him writing away in his notebook for about half an hour as I recited all of the things the Mau Mau did, that they murdered more black people, Kikuyu, than they did white people, and more other black tribes, Luo and Maasai and other folk like that in Kenya, that the Governor General of Kenya, Sir Michael Renison, called him a Satanist and the leader to darkness and death. And I described some of the Mau Mau, and you wouldn't believe the disgusting things that people had to drink while reciting the various grades of the Mau Mau oath. Poor Inspector Rose, he said, "I charged it." And did the defendant make any reply? Yes, he did. What did he say? And they expected just a couple of sentences that people usually give. The poor man to stand in the dock and read my speech for me. And this was reported in the papers. The public, I was fined £400.
Well, you've raised for that.
Oh, yes, in public support it was paid. Yeah, and also 2 months in prison, which meant with remission 40 days in Brixton prison. And the money was, well, the £400 was kept for the party, but the public sent to Bow Street Magistrates Court more than enough money to pay the fine. And the Tobacco Workers Union in Kenya demanded the British government provide a sacrificial ox as an act of atonement. But whether the British government ever did, I expect they did. I did 40 days in Brixton prison, and my first disappointment with John Tyndall, which I was too young to appreciate the significance of at the time, but I realised it, and we've all got 20/20 hindsight, haven't we? I would have expected him to keep, okay, a lot of the money was used to bring out the first edition of the magazine Spearhead, but I would have expected after 40 days in the slammer, and I'd lost my job and all that sort of thing, that he would have kept back £10. Or even a fiver, right, of it, to help me readjust to life outside prison again. Not a penny. Mm-hmm. And I had to go crawling back to my parents for a little bit of financial assistance, which I didn't want to do. And if ever you're 18 or 19, anybody is listening to this, and somebody does something like that to you, then take it seriously. It's a marker. But there we are. That was how things went. And after a while, out of prison, I realised the Greater Britain movement under John Tyndall wasn't going anywhere. So I left politics and opened up a bookshop in my hometown, St Albans, and did that for 5 years. A new, not a second-hand bookshop, you know, ordinary general new books, in a little 15th-century building near the St Albans Abbey. And when the next Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference came along, I found a car stationed outside my bookshop front door with two men in it, and it was parked on a double yellow line. Couldn't believe it. You know, it's a narrow, tiny little Tudor street. So I went outside and said, "You chaps are going to get nicked, aren't you?" He said, "No, we're not, Martin. We are the Nickers." And they turned out to be two special branch men. And they said, "We're staying here to make sure you don't attack any foreign dignitaries." I said, "I didn't attack the last one. I just wanted to present him a document." They said, yeah. "Well, we're not having any more of that nonsense." So I brought them into the shop, made them a cup of coffee, and I rang up Scotland Yard and spoke and asked them who I should speak to, and spoke to their line manager or whoever was in charge of the special branch. And I said, "Look, I'm running a business now. These two men for a week, while this conference is on, sitting out my front door, not getting nicked, all my fellow shopkeepers are going to ask what's going on." And I said, "I don't think it's appropriate." So, "Well, if you can promise us that you won't dodge off somewhere and do anything naughty during the period of the Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference, then we'll withdraw our men to the St. Albans police station, providing everywhere you go, once you close your shop, they are with you until you go to bed." So I had two special branch chauffeurs for the week, and I made them trip me in and out of London and hither and yon. And they were good lads. They really enjoyed themselves. I organized a group of people to go to a conference or a meeting at the London School of Economics, which is the very left-wing university in London. And these two coppers, special branch men, sat at the back while these young voices were mixed in the audience, and we heckled the speaker after speaker. And one Asian speaker, after all this heckling had gone on with the other people, the poor man, frightened as a bird, went up to the rostrum and promptly fainted. And at the end of the meeting, these special branch men were rollicking with laughter. They'd never seen anything so funny and in all of that, and then drove me all the way from London back to St. Albans again, 25-30 miles, before they then had to go home. And there they were, 8 o'clock the next morning, outside the bookshop. Well, they rang me up from St. Albans police station saying, "You there, and you let us know if you move." So that's how it carried on. And I didn't do much in politics, almost nothing, until the League of Empire Loyalists and John Bean's British National Party came together to form the National Front.
What year was that?
That they came together in 1967. I watched them through the end of 67, 68. Unfortunately, even at that early stage, the party was plagued with division. Chesterton was prepared to allow John Tyndall to join the National Front, because his Greater Britain movement, he dissolved and told all of its members to join the National Front. But Tyndall himself wasn't allowed to join. And eventually he started nagging away, and Fountain was very much against it, because Fountain was afraid that if Tyndall joined, then the succession of who was going to be the next leader would be denied him. He assumed that he was going to take over from Chesterton when Chesterton fell off.
Andrew Fountain,
yes, who was a British National Party bigwig, mm-hmm. and a close pal of John Bean. And there was a big ruckus over that. And Chesterton, being an old-style fascist type, simply wrote a letter to Andrew Fountain saying, "You're expelled." Well, we have a thing called Magna Carta in this country, and basic civil rights, and going back to, 1215, wasn't it, Magna Carta, something like that, whereby you can't be punished or have sanctions imposed on you unless you have a charge put against you, and you've got the right to represent yourself before some sort of tribunal. So Fountain got a very top barrister, Lord Hailsham, who later became a cabinet minister with the Tories, to represent him. And the case was won hands down, and Chesterton had to pay the costs of that. And then the movement assembled at an annual general meeting, and the membership voted him out. And he had a chance to have his say. And the jury in that case was the membership assembled at an annual general meeting, and he was waved goodbye to. The important thing about the National Front was it was the first movement to properly constitute itself. That's to say, to provide itself with a constitution, just like every other proper political, the way in which the national leadership is elected and regularly re-elected, the governing body, the chairman of the National Directorate, how branches are constituted, how their committees and fun. In other words, a constitution to lay out how the party is organised and what people's rights and responsibilities were if they took office, that sort of thing. And it worked very well for the National Front. And the National Front did good deeds, good things. We fought elections. And in 1973, I was tricked into being the NS candidate in a parliamentary by-election in West Bromwich. We'd got all of our candidates lined up for the general election. And people were prepared to do that, to stand in the general election, because then they'd be standing with so many other candidates that they wouldn't stand out. But when somebody died and there was a by-election for this constituency, the man who'd been adopted, a local man, to be the NF candidate said, no, I can't do it. He wasn't prepared to stand in a parliamentary by-election because he was focused too much personal publicity on him. And I went up there in order to chair the meeting at which he was introduced as the candidate. And it ended up that I ended up being the candidate. So I had 3 weeks to organise a parliamentary by-election. We got out a leaflet through the post. We just about managed to get that printed and delivered to the post office in time for free distribution, because all party candidates get that right if they pay their deposit and get themselves properly nominated with the correct nomination papers, then the post office will give them a free distribution of a leaflet to every voter. And in addition to that, we put posters up everywhere, and I spent my time with a loudspeaker car just going into the council estate. It was still more or less a white town then. It's not now. White town. I used to go into a block of housing development and put the megaphones of the loudspeakers up to the buildings and give them 10 minutes of vote National Front, put the British people first. We didn't fight two world wars to become second-class citizens in our own country. And you could look up the building, and after about 5 minutes of that sort of simple nationalist rhetoric, the sort of thing that people we know were saying to one another in pubs and in shops, people were opening the windows and listening. And we had a march along West Bromwich High Street, which is the longest high street in England. We started off with 150 people, mostly brought in from outside the area with flags and banners and that sort of thing. By the time we got to the other end of the high street, we had 2,000 people behind us. People were coming out of the shops, leaving bus stops, mothers with pushchairs, with children in the pushchairs and prams. And by the time we got to the town hall for our meeting, we had 2,000 people behind us. And I got 16.02% of the poll, which is the first time any racial nationalist candidate before or after the Second World War saved a deposit in a parliamentary by-election. And the enemy freaked out. We were on BBC Radio. I was brought into the world at one, interviewed by a horrible man called William Hardcastle, who wouldn't even say good afternoon to me. And I kept on saying to him, Mr. Hardcastle, good afternoon. Oh, very well, then, good afternoon. He wanted to convey to the listeners that he's only got this horrible person here on sufferance, you know. It got a lot of publicity, and it showed that we could make an impact with the British electorate.
Right.
And it got us more interested in fighting elections, parliamentary by-elections, which we did a string of, 8%, 9%, 7%, 4%, but still, you know, in there nibbling away Well, there's such a lot of history in the National Front, the things that we did, the marches that we held. Some people disapprove of our marches because they led to riots. Well, the multiracial society is going to lead to a race war in this country, and the little riots that accompanied our marches are going to be nothing compared to the rivers of blood correctly prophesied for this country by Enoch Powell in 1968. And did you know, as a sheer coincidence, and that speech was delivered on April the 20th, 1968. That was a pure coincidence, but it's one of those remarkable happenstances that a warning to this country was delivered on that date, and we thought it was quite amusing at the time. But some of our people thought, oh no, now we're doing well in elections, we mustn't have any more of these disturbances. The whole point is that you've got to be right. The only way we could get publicity, because the media wasn't prepared to grant us free and fair and even publicity, we had to do outrageous things in order to attract press publicity. They say no, all publicity is good publicity, or there's no such thing as bad publicity. I don't think that's quite true. But keeping yourself before the public is terribly important, even if it's not good, always good publicity. We did various stunts, and we proposed to have a march in 1977 in Manchester, or a borough of Manchester, called Thamesmead. And the Labour Council of Thamesmead and the Chief Constable got together and agreed, under the terms of the Public Order Act, as it then was, to ban the march. So I knew this ban was going to come, so I went up to a pub next to the town hall called a press conference and said, well, they've banned this march, so we're going to have to adjust our strategy. And I said, what we're going to do is I'm going to hold a one-man march along the route that we were going to march with a banner saying, defend free speech against red terrorism. And the rest of the movement is going to hold a march in another borough, in which marches haven't been banned. And we're not going to announce where it's going to happen. And we're going to show that where the Reds don't get advance notice of where we're going to march, we can march through a part of our country and get support from ordinary people on the side street, which they may be frightened to express if there's rioting and red mobs around the place. But if we hold a surprise march, and that's how we're going to do it. And I'm going to hold a banner saying, Mr. What was his name now, that chief constable? Oh, I forget his name. It'll come to me in just a minute. The chief constable, Chief Constable so-and-so, defend our freedom of speech against red terrorists. And he rang me up after this press conference. He rang me up the next day and said, will you come up to Manchester and we'll have a chat? And he was a very short little man. So he had a special big magnificent desk built for himself, but a specially low one. So it wasn't just his head peering over the top of the desk. He said to me, he was a Methodist lay preacher. He said, I'm a very moral man, you know. Oh, I said, he said, I don't think we can ban or say that your walk by yourself, this so-called one-man march, is a breach of the Public Order Act ban on marches in that borough. I'll allow you to do what you want and facilitate your other march for you in another borough, which will you say you're going to keep secret. I'll facilitate that too, as long as you remove my name from your poster. So I thought that was a deal. All right. And Anderson, that's the man's name, Chief Constable Anderson. And Anderson, that was the man's name. And it all went tickety-boo. The BBC made a documentary film called Inside Story about how I organised the one-man march and how we organised to get our coaches from all different parts of the country to go to the part of Manchester that we were going to march in that hadn't got a Public Order ban against it. I made a very good movie for the BBC documentary. And a huge amount of publicity. And it was all a big wind-up because we were all looking towards a general election.
Now, what year was this?
Well, the general election was 1979. Okay. A lot of people thought it was going to be in 78, but it didn't. They held off, and it didn't happen until 1979. And we had several other, we had big demonstrations, we had a big march and a big riot in Lewisham in South London, where white women, elderly white women, that's to say, grannies, were continuously being mugged by young gangs of young black muggers. And the white folks there were getting fed up with this. And the Duke of Edinburgh went on a walk, not the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Charles did a walkabout in that area, pandering to the blacks as if they were the victims of this, patting them on the head, even speaking to a Maoist leader of the local Socialist Workers' Party there, chatting with him. The white people were ignored by Prince Charles. He was desperate to show himself as a modern multiracialist proto-monarch. And so we decided to have a march, and that was a very serious riot. Well, you know, it destroyed the centre of the town, really, and it was, you know, quite a frightening occasion as well, because the Jews had formed an organisation called the Anti-Nazi League, and the National Front wasn't a Nazi party, it was a racial nationalist party. But this group, the so-called Anti-Nazi League, was formed at the instigation of a Labour Party organisation called the Labour Friends of Israel. And they negotiated an agreement with a supposedly anti-Zionist Trotskyite organisation called the Socialist Workers' Party, which was run by a man called Tony Cliff. Now, you hear the word Tony Cliff, you think, well, you're talking to about a traditional British horny-handed son of toil. But in fact, his real name was Yigal Gluckstein. And he was an Israeli citizen. And you'd got the Labour Friends of Israel, who were pro-Zionist, working in an alliance with the Socialist Workers' Party, a Trotskyite anti-Zionist group, in order to form the Anti-Nazi League. This was deployed against us. And the Labour Party, to launch their Anti-Nazi League, which was in the first instance supported officially by the Board of Deputies of British Jews, which is the representative body of British Jewry. The Labour Party devoted the whole of its party political broadcast. Parties in Parliament are allowed once a year to have 5 or 10 minutes giving out their point of view, if they're in Parliament. We weren't in Parliament, of course. So we had 15 minutes of the Labour Party not attacking the Conservatives or the Liberals or other people in Parliament, attacking a little party that hadn't got a single person in Parliament, devoting the whole of its broadcast. Shows how frightened the Jews and the Communists were of the National Front, our potential.
So how many people were members or supporters at the time?
10,000 at the top. 9,000, 10,000. That was all. That was that top whack. But we could mobilise up quite a lot of people on the streets, and we got fairish results in local council elections as well as in parliamentary by-elections. And the Anti-Nazi League simply mobilised mobs of Trotskyite and communist thugs. And as soon as the cap was running, the Jewish Board of Directors knew that the Anti-Nazi League was going to lead to violence, so they withdrew. But by then, the clockwork mouse was running around, right, doing what it was. And it was an attempt to use physical violence to stop us, meetings, election meetings, all that sort of thing. People were intimidated, candidates were intimidated in their homes. And the level of intimidation and physical violence intimidation was subversive of any sort of democratic setup and completely unprecedented in British parliamentary history, unless you count the election meetings described by Dickens and Mr. Pickwick. They were completely unprecedented.
I remember reading in William Joyce's Twilight Over England about dust-ups in the 1930s with Jewish...
Oh, fights, and, yes. Yeah. But the point is this, the Mosley movement didn't do too much electoral activity.
Okay.
We were predicated on electoral activity. They tried to stop us participating in electoral activity, which is what extremists don't do. They try to circumvent the ballot box and go to power directly through violence and revolution. We try to show we are in the mainstream of British politics and we're trying to advance our cause through local and national parliamentary elections.
Right.
And the Jews mobilized the Trotskyites and, of course, the mass media with their scurrilous propaganda to try and block us off, away from political involvement. And we were told the last time we stood in a general election that we wouldn't be allowed more than 5 minutes a radio broadcast during the election, unlike the other parties, the established parties, because they've got people in Parliament. And we'd need to put up at least 300 candidates before we'd be considered for a second more time for a parliamentary broadcast. So we did. We put up, I think, 303, 308 candidates. Didn't get another second from the BBC. On there, they all got together and said, oh, no, unprecedented, no, you just have your 5 minutes. That's how it went. And obviously, we didn't get anybody elected in that general election, though we made a huge impact. And in my opinion, every political party that doesn't win in a general election experiences a downturn. The politics is a long-term thing, and things pick up again.